nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
I want to kick off today's webinar. The title of the webinar is The Future of Food and Agriculture from Macro to Nano, Opportunities and Challenges. Our presenter today will be Dr. Carmen Gomez. She's in the Mechanical Engineering Department at Iowa State University. This webinar is part of the NAC Network, or Nanotechnology Applications and Career Knowledge Resource Center. We are funded by the NSF ATE, or Advanced Technological Education. We're a regional center. We are actually a part of the Center for Nanotechnology Education and Utilization here at Penn State University, and we're in the College of Engineering, the Engineering Science and Mechanics. And you probably could tell that from the Penn State logo at the bottom of this slide. I didn't introduce myself. I think probably looking at the folks there, probably a lot of you already know me. My name is Bob Ehrman. I'm the managing director here at the Penn State NAC Center that I talked about earlier. My colleague today, the other host, co-host, will be Dr. Oskar Kakmak, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Thank you, Bob. So I'm an assistant teaching professor here at Penn State, working also in the field of nanotechnology, and we'll be expecting questions from you, like Bob said, in the Q&A section, and I'll be very happy to direct them to Dr. Gomez. So I'll be leaving the floor to you, Dr. Gomez.
Thank you very much. I really, first, before I start, I just want to thank you for taking the time to do this and let people know that the first time I saw you was at a Nano Stakeholders meeting, NNI Stakeholders meeting in January, and I thought you were a fabulous presenter, and this topic was so relevant to today, so I thought it would be great for you to share this with our webinar audience, and I thank you very much for doing this for us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be presenting to this community. I didn't know about it, so it's great that you guys found me and to be involved in it, and it's a pleasure, and I hope you guys find my presentation interesting, and I'm very pleased to follow up with questions, and if for some reason we cannot address them today, we can always reach out to me by email. I'll be happy to do that. A few things, I guess, introducing about myself. My background is actually in agriculture and biological engineering. This accent that you get from me, it's because I'm originally from Brazil. I got my bachelor's there in food processing, and then I came here to the United States 2 decades ago to pursue my PhD in biological and agriculture engineering. Initially, I was at Texas A&M. I got my tenure there. And then finally, I moved about 3 years ago to Iowa State University, and I joined the Mechanical Engineering Department with research focus on nanotechnology. So as you can see, the title of my talk, it's very broad. I really wanted to introduce to you in a big overview on the problems that we face with food and agriculture, and how we can, by doing a systematic approach, be able to pinpoint where we can tackle those big complex questions that we have to this day. And hopefully you can see how one way or another you can contribute to the solution. We know that these are big problems that we are facing right now, but not necessarily we can tackle them with one silver bullet. There is no one solution for the problem. So by tackling them in different ways, we can actually address the problem and hopefully achieve a solution in the next few years. So again, we are all thinking about, if you could, we would be trying to somehow, one way or another, to end hunger, to achieve food security and improve nutrition to all the world, in all the population in the world, and also to promote sustainable agricultural practices. So we know that those problems are still relevant, and we haven't been able to solve this in 2021, and unlikely we will be able to solve in next year. This is going to be something that we will need to be continuously working towards, and hopefully in a decade or so, we will be able to reduce, or hopefully completely eliminate those problems. And I believe, and I hope by the end of this talk, you will see that nanotechnology can play a role in tackling those problems. And ideally, we will be one of the sources of the solution. So this slide that I have here is kind of showing you that this is a complex problem, and the things are interconnected. So when we talk about food security, ending creating sustainable practices in agriculture and also making food nutritious and available for everyone. This is, again, interconnected with health. And you can see that not only this is a slide is actually from the USDA. You can see that the USDA has been funding many aspects of research that are interconnected to those problems. And nanotechnology, again, can play a role all the way from tackling antimicrobial resistance, probiotic activity, pest disease and detection diagnostics, pest management, water quality, soil health, animal planet and health, crop production. So it goes all the way from the microorganism level all the way to the food we eat. And there is a role there for nanotechnology to assist and hopefully help minimizing the problems that we're dealing. And this slide is mainly to show that there is a big interconnect on agriculture and health. And by having a sustainable agriculture, we can also impact how health, how human health is also impacted. And one way of dealing with those complex problems that I just mentioned to you about is that, we tackle this as a system approach. It's not based on, we don't think about technologies, we think about systems. We don't think about determining problems, we think about empowering people. We don't do things by design, but actually we, by default, we do by design. And values are features, they are not bugs. And instead of just solving one thing at a time, we try to connect the dots and see how they are interconnected. So you can see here that we are heading towards the fourth industrial revolution. And more you can see that this is no longer just about technology. It's about cyber-physical systems, which means that computer data analysis and technologies, physical technologies, they are interconnected. And computing more and more is becoming a tool for us to be able to drive our decisions, to help us make decision-making. But the human component is very important because at the end of the day, it's the human that is actually making decision and driving to the solution. So this was provided by the Economic Forum. It's basically saying that, again, the human factor plays a huge impact on how decisions are made. And the technology that we are developing now more and more is to aid on the decision making, not necessarily to overtake the decision or the human aspects of things. So I will give you examples here on how we can break down the big problems that we have and how they are interconnected. So yes, we need to food for the next billion of people, but also at the same time, you need to be thinking about if we are developing new food products, they need to be food for nutrition, but also for enjoyment. We, especially if you have the ability to choose the food you eat, you will eat the ones that bring you, that are tasteful, that are bring you pleasure in overall. And at the same time, there is the fact that you don't only want to eat for feed, you want to eat for health. And we have actually a big discussion yesterday with one of the programs offered by the program that you guys have, where people really talked about that more and more we are designing food to be functional. So they are not only for feeding, but also for nutrition, for health. So it's become more and more aware to the overall population that food is more than just feed. So I will give you examples here and how we can tackle those big problems that we have. So food for food wastage is a big problem. How can we break it down in a way that we eventually can tackle different contributing small aspects of things related to food waste and at the same time promote food for health, food for nutrition. Also, I will talk about health aging and food for pleasure. So just giving you examples by breaking it down in small chunks, we can actually tackle these problems in different approaches and hopefully being able to come up with a solution. So the problem of food waste is a major factor to this day in both developing and developed countries. And you can see here on the on the cycle of on the food life cycle, that the most of the food wastage happens either at the production side while you're harvesting, so when you are harvesting the material, or at the consumer level. And which ways of tackling that would be managing inputs and influence behavior. And in the next slide, I will discuss the ones that are the biggest problems. So, for example, cereals, you usually have about 30% wastage, then followed by fish and seafood, fresh fruits and produce, and also roots and tubers are the ones that have a big percentage in terms of wastage. Let's look at first the fruit and vegetable losses. So waste reduced fruit and vegetable losses, again, break it down into small chunks and saying and seeing how we can tackle. So 45% of fruits and vegetables are wasted. So just think about everything you produce in a farm, 45% of that will never hit the consumer plate, it will never be consumed. So it's clearly very significant. So in North America, over 2/3 of the losses occur in agriculture, in the production section, and at the end, at the table, before being consumed by consumption levels. So one way of tackling this would be, for example, self-protection of post-harvest. So maybe improving crops, so they have antioxidant resistance, they have hormones, and they can better regulate the respiration rates, so they have extended shelf life. So can we do some type of crop management or plant breeding or genetic modifications that actually improve the resistance of the crop to last longer? Use more the ugly, so change the bar, make them perfect, perfect shape, perfect taste. So different ways of tackling it. Either you make it more perfect, or you can use the ugly and process in a way that is going to be accepted by the consumers. Another point of addressing the problem would be the disruption. So can we avoid disrupting the distribution? And we saw this happening a lot during the pandemic, right? A lot of the farmers end up having to put their produce to waste because there was no way to distribute to the initial consumers, which were restaurant chains and so forth. So closer the disruption, the closer to consumption, storage, packaging, send surplus, needy in deserts. So maybe be able to connect to other places where there is a desert place, what we call food deserts. And it's actually, this is very common here in the United States. Disrupt restaurants and retail models. So that would be one way. So tackle the logistics. Waste to value. So use all parts. Maybe the parts that right now is waste, you can repurpose to making into packaging material. Mind nutraceuticals of functional ingredients. There is a lot of research going on that, being able to extract some of the phytochemicals and making them functional foods. And other examples would be recall and food safety. So can we improve that? Can we track back properly the food, avoid them to actually being distributed with problem before they get to the consumer? So use traceability, blockchain, whole genomic analysis, fresh and beyond fresh. So can we improving low carbon footprint and high quality food preservation? So maybe do some, we talked about yesterday, taxation for materials that have high carbon footprint. Packaging, kitchen technology, so can we improve that? Other examples beyond food, so can we process into biofuels, packaging, cosmetics, supplements, other products? So again, just a few examples, and I would say right now that research is going on in all those aspects of things. And it's a matter really to see what you have available for you at your institution or at your local educational system, and see what you could probably help. And another one, another example that I wanted to talk about is reduce cereal food losses. Again, 30% is lost in North America due to either, most of that happens at the household consumption level. And one example here, one shell of the problem is eat all parts. So learn how to eat whole grains and educate the consumers that this is healthy and beneficial to their system. Find more use. So plant-based beyond protein, promote plant-based cereal diet. Make them even healthier. So provide complex carbs for sustainable health. Optimize processing to retain nutrition. So people, when they eat cereal, they will find out that they are not just having a source of carbohydrate, but they also find all the nutraceuticals that benefit their health in overall. And preservation, so extend the shelf life using natural consumers-friendly methods and packaging technologies. That would be some of the examples we could use to tackle the problem of food waste. Now, when it comes to pleasure, so if you're going to really try to, again, feed the world, you need to convince consumers. And again, food is something that is very cultural attached. It's one of the few things that we have control, right? We choose what we eat. So it needs to be something that is not only healthy, but also it brings you pleasure. It's something that you enjoy eating day to day. So healthy food should taste good. So what influences, things that influences our choices on what we eat. So sight, it's one. Another one, taste and flavor. So it needs to have the right texture. It needs to have the right smell and taste good first overall. And so again, mouthfeel and sound, texture is very, very important. We all know that if a chip is not crunchy, it's not a chip. So and satisfaction beyond taste. So you need to also know the aspect of, okay, if I eat this, I know it's going to help my system. So I want to consume that. So ways that we could tackle this. So in terms of what influences food choices, human psychology, marketing, food accessibility. So retail, vending, restaurants, and e-commerce models. So again, talking about food deserts, right? There are places that it's difficult to send fresh produce because they don't have the transportation, the distribution is not perfect. So can you design foods that they have a longer shelf life, they can be shelf stable? So again, taste and flavor. So we can work on flavor of sciences, human receptors, ingredient innovations. All those things play a lot on how taste and flavor are developed. Two, sight, color, and luminescence. More and more, consumers are aware of natural pigments. That is a big drive for eating things that are all natural. So if you can replace chemical synthetic colorants by using natural pigments, this is a big, something seen very valuable by consumers. Processing without destruction of the pigments, for example, preservation and packaging, or also the nutraceuticals that are in the product. In terms of mouthfeel, so food oral processing, thinking about the texture is, again, a very important component. Processing technologies to change the texture, to make it interesting, and other types of technologies that basically allow for you to play with the texture. So just think about that you probably have seen some chips made of vegetables, and the way they do it, they do some osmotic processing. Basically, they change the water with some other types, with infusion of carbohydrates, usually dextrins and carbohydrates that you are not going to break down. And then after that, they freeze dry it or they vacuum fry it. And then you have right there a possibility of eating a vegetable chip that has the right texture and ideally keeping the same color, is appealing to the color, is appealing to the mouthfeel and all that. So now thinking about, again, it's not just about feeding, it's about taste, but also it's about thinking about the future, how this food is going to be helpful for me in the long run. Is this going to benefit my health? So health aging, you need to keep in mind that it's like a retirement account. It's something that you need to start thinking about when you're still young, because you know that by feeding properly, by eating healthy, we will avoid problems with chronic diseases such as diabetes and in other diseases. I'm just thinking about diabetes right now, immunological diseases, allergies, and so forth. So it's all interconnected, and you can see this also reflected in medicine. People are now more thinking about the whole system, the human whole system. They know that certain diseases are interconnected. So if you have diabetes, probably there is some impact on your digestive system that also affects your immunological system. And how, again, food impacts your health. And knowing that our system is nothing but a big, a complex system as well, that breaks down the food that we eat into different components and then eventually gets distributed in our body. So this has a huge impact on how the food we eat plays on the overall health that we have. And again, now more and more, we see problems with allergies, problems with digestion, and the interconnection of our immunological system, and how we can, by choosing the food we eat, we can control and reduce or probably improve based on that. So again, I guess my message here is the problem is complex and there is not one solution. So those diets that tell you, oh, you just should eat celery and that's going to save your problems, it's a very simplistic approach. You need to tackle this thinking about the different types of food that I eat has an impact on my overall system and consequently on my health. So again, the idea here is that hopefully by thinking big and at the same time breaking it down into small questions and sometimes not really understand all the components and the interconnections, we still are able to tackle the problem. So we need to, again, reframe our thoughts, break the bottlenecks and shift the paradigms. And the way to do that is by, again, doing a systems approach and hopefully tackling small components of that, seeing how those things are interconnected. And sometimes we don't know, but by going is small and at the same time asking the same questions and revisiting the big question, we can actually address the problem. So macro system thinking problems to solve. So we have, again, for example, a carbon footprint and this impact on climate change. And how can we tackle these when you talk about food production? So understand, for example, food degradation mechanisms, the physiological aspects of eating, oral processing of food, so texture aspects of things, food health interaction, distress is due to food allergens and intolerances. Be able to detect, control, and connect. So spoilage detection, pathogen detection, biomarkers for health, supply chain traceability, food distribution and disruption. So again, many aspects, many components to a big problem, and breaking it down into small chunks, we are able to tackle the problem and hopefully advance in solving it. So preserve and extend use, safe and effective preservation, sustainable packaging and preservation, reduce packaging use while preserving food, new food for food waste, new use for food waste, waste less, use all parts of plants, more plant-based, deliver health and joy, so food structure manipulation, food structure preservation, macromolecular interaction, encapsulation and release of bioactives, tailored release kinetics, minimally processed safe food. So those are some of the examples. And now my call that nanotechnology can tackle this, can help with that. And you will see that I'll give you some examples. So safe and consumer accepted. So educational for safety. So we should never forget the public perception. And public should be involved in all aspects of the things that I'm just talking about. If you don't gain the trust of the public, you definitely will lose the confidence that your technology is viable. So education for safety, education for biology and biotech, safety of new materials, safety of new technologies, ecosystems view of technologies and interactions. Those things are very important. And also, I believe if the consumers are aware and they see the benefits of the new technologies, they actually can make become the bigger voice, and they can bring this to Congress, to the higher ups, I would say, to convince that funding is necessary for this type of research. So it is very important to have consumers' acceptance. So my call here is to say that shift to nano to find the, and change the bottleneck. So nanotechnology can definitely help assisting this by, again, looking at plant breeding, by understanding how phytochemicals are produced, how you can properly intensify the production of certain chemicals, nutraceuticals that you wanted to see on your produce. It's one example. Also being able to extract some of those nutraceuticals and be able to create delivery systems that will make them more easily absorbed by our body would be another example. Using materials that are right now considered waste into packaging to improve the shelf life of the product, to be able to send it to places that right now cannot be reached. Also by extending the shelf life, but also making the material biodegradable. And an example here is by understanding digestion systems and by creating delivery systems that can properly help deliver of an active component that will be considered maybe a probiotic or a prebiotic, or even an antioxidant component can be done using nanotechnology materials. And also by here on the right hand side, I'm showing by doing genetic modifications of crops that benefit them to become pest resistant, that make them, again, produce more of the components that you want, and they make them have a longer shelf life and so forth. So these are some of the examples that nanotechnology can help. And I also want to call for being able to measure those things. So one part of my research is related to development of sensors that allows us to measure changes in the environment, hopefully, ideally, user-friendly. So things that we see in terms of sensing that are in need right now, and I want to just highlight a few of them, that when you design a sensor, you should think about who is going to be using it and how it's going to be implemented in the field. So using Spire sensors design, consider the triple bottom line. So you need to think about sustainability, the economic, the environmental, and the social values of this particular system that sensor that you are developing. So you need to think not only what the sensor is going to be doing, but what is the system that is going to be applied. So again, the cultural aspects, the environmental aspects, and the economic aspects of it, so it actually becomes deployable. Tools that can support interoperability. When I say that, it's basically trying to inform that if you're developing a sensor for the production side of things, ideally you want it to be able to, whatever the data you collect from the sensor, it's going to be translatable to somebody that is actually in the next level of production, so in the processing plant. So, and then again, when it comes to the consumer level, can you allow the data to be informative all the way to the end and make it interoperable, I guess. And another drive, especially if you're thinking about agriculture and food applications, is that it would be very valuable to have biodegradable materials being used for sensors, because sometimes they will be left in the field and you want them to not be a problem in the future. So this is the midpoint. I wonder if you guys have any questions. I know I speak a little too fast, but I wanted to cover a lot of material.
Yeah, this is going great. So we'll be waiting for the questions coming from the Q&A part. But in the meantime, Dr. Gomez, Bob and I, we have always been talking about like these kind of global problems. And one of them is, of course, the carbon footprint. And you also talked about it, too, in the food production. So how do you see the on the government level, like how do the governments in the whole, like in the general sense, the worldwide are tackling this problem of the carbon footprint production?
I think Right now, I don't think there is much happening, but there's some talks about taxation or maybe some type of credits, right? So carbon footprint credits for the... So if companies can show that they are reducing their carbon footprint, and as you guys can see, when it comes to food production, we have a major carbon footprint because of the amount of energy and water that it takes for producing food, and considering the wastage that we have. I don't think here in the United States there is much talk about credits and taxation, but I would say that in Europe you hear more about it, that they want to provide companies with credits if they show that they are reducing their carbon footprint, or tax them if they tend to increase, depending on what they are developing.
So Bob just sent me a question. He's asking, how about on the investment side? The government's investing in technological solutions?
I think
about that.
Yes, there is investment. Obviously, there are funding agencies that fund food and agriculture research. One of the major ones would be USDA, NIFA. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of the funding that comes to food and agriculture comes from this agency. But more and more over the years, the funding available from government agencies has been reduced, focus on food and agriculture. And a lot of the funding is now coming through industry, which changed the dynamics on how research is done. Because usually industry research is not much in the fundamental side of things. It's more on the shorter term. And sometimes, especially in agriculture, it takes about 10 to 15 years for a new product to come to market because of all the lab work that needs to happen. Or just think about plant breeding. It takes about that long for you to develop a new crop, which is pest resistance, for example, and so forth. So there is funding, but it's been reducing over and over the time, over the years. And I must say that every time there has been some research done about when you reduce funding in agriculture, how is that impact in the urban areas? It's actually major. It's we were talking about for every... I need to look at the slides that I have in my background, but it is like a tenfold impact. Every time you reduce the funding in the agricultural sector, tenfold is reduced at the urban side. So it's, again, very interconnected.
Do you see like a globally the same kind of trends? If you like from, for example, do you know whether that's also happening in a similar fashion in Brazil?
So it seems to be actually a global event. More and more funding is going to other areas, let's say urban areas or other types of industry sectors, manufacturing and so forth, but not really in agriculture and food, even though we know that for a sustainable world, we need both things to work. So,
right. So I think we will touch more on the nano mm-hmm. part in the second part of the talk, but we just have a mm-hmm. question that just arrived. Jane is asking, can you give an example of a sensor that might be developed?
Yes. So the next few minutes, I'll go over some of the sensors that mm-hmm. have been developed. And even considering low resource places. So by the end of this talk, you will see that nanotechnology does not need to be just for developed countries. It can reach developing countries and it can make an impact in low resource areas if you properly plan for that. So hopefully in the next few minutes.
yeah, we can now continue with the second part, I believe, since we don't have any questions coming up so far. Yeah,
okay.
Let's go on. Thank you very much.
All right, so all that I talked about here is kind of trying to drive the message that convergence of different disciplines is needed to be able to tackle those big questions. And why it is convergence? Basically, is again, having a multi-transdisciplinary approach to a complex problem, let's say end hunger in the world. And you can see that we have different factors playing. And initially, they converge all together to try to answer this question. And based on the develops on the research and over time, you see that you will gain knowledge, you will impact economically, you will impact the consumers, you will have things diverging into different branches. That's the divergence part. It will be impact natural resources, policy regulation, and so forth. So key players converge to address an individual challenge, and eventually things diverge and spin off in products and ideas. So again, the importance of having a transdisciplinary approach to tackle a big complex problem is needed. And as you can see on this slide saying, we may not need to understand all the connections amongst the pieces and the puzzles. And we need to actually allow ourselves to lose focus on them because again, you don't expect an engineer to know how the economic side of things really play. You need somebody that is an expert in economics to be able to help to tackle these problems. So convergence science is based on dynamic focusing. So you will be in and out of focus depending on the question that you are trying to answer. But you need to trust that by providing your input, your expertise, you will be advancing and hopefully being able to solve the solution. So we must allow ourselves to be temporarily out of focus to see the problem anew. And from time to time, go back and ask the question again to be able to make sure that you are not losing the focus of the big question, okay? So now the next slides, I will show you that nanotechnology can be used in low resource areas. You don't need to be in a developed country to make an impact. And if you do it properly, you can really help the community that you are tackling. So I'll give you a couple of examples and hopefully try to emphasize that to be able to do that, you have to obviously understand the context that you are in, the culture, and most important, the people that are involved in that. So how can we meet the food security, safety, and sovereignty need of low-income communities? And these examples that I'm showing here are slides from Professor Diana Vanegas at Clemson University. She has done some amazing work related to environmental justice in Colombia. And I guess that's my suggestion for a future speaker, if you guys want to have somebody to describe that in more detail. But basically what she did is she used very cheap, easy accessible technology to be able to create sensors in a low-income setting. So she went to Amazon and purchased a low-cost millisecond pulsed laser, and she was able to create sensors using a very rapid fabrication method. So here is showing what she did. She purchased Kapton tape that is highly used everywhere in electronics. She used a backing of photo paper to give some support. And then she lays the surface of the polyimide, the Kapton tape, to create what we call laser-induced graphene or laser-inscribed graphene. So basically she converts this polymer into something that is electrically conductive. And once it's electrically conductive, she can functionalize the surface with biorecognition agents that are specific to what you are trying to measure. In this case, she used this for measuring histamines. Histamines are allergens, and they are very prevalent in fish products and fermented fish. Also, you can find histamines in wine. Basically, histamines are this degradation of a protein that you find in fish. Basically, the amino acid histamine breaks down histidine breaks down into histamines, and this induces allergic reaction in our body if it's in higher concentrations. So she used that. And the cost of this particular sensor was less than 40 cents. And what is interesting too is that all the components that she used to fabricate the sensor can be purchased locally and can be manufactured there without the need of you shipping things from the United States. Also, another example of what she has done, she created carbon dots using a kitchen microwave and using kitchen materials such as they spray the, I forgot now the name, Windex, using Windex sugar and a microwave. She was able to create those carbon dots. They are very sensitive to the presence of mercury. So they decrease the fluorescence in the presence of mercury. And at the same time, she corrected that interference, correct the reading of the carbon dots with pH by using a colorimetric pH sensor that is based on anthocyanins from cabbage. So anthocyanins are the pigments that give color in cabbage, the purple cabbage. So she extracted that and used that as a pH sensor because anthocyanins can go from a dark blue all the way to transparent based on the pH range. And she used that to be able to measure mercury in water. And again, with that help of some, developed some algorithms, she was able to process the data using a smartphone app. And he's just showing some of the performance of, for the mercury biosensor. So he was able to measure very low concentrations of mercury in water. And it has a very broad range of concentrations. And here is just demonstrating the electrodes that is connected to a potential stat that is portable and very affordable. It's one-time purchase. It's about $500, but you can, once you buy it, you can use it for different modalities of sensing. And the app allows you for interpreting the data, but also offers cybersecurity so the data is protected. And at the same time, it offers, in this case for Colombia, it allows you to do GIS and locate pinpoint where the water was collected so they could map concentrations of mercury in different areas of the region. And she got this published recently. And here's just showing that she did a comparative work using locally resourced materials. In analytical grade one, she was able to build the sensors and allow them to be used in low resource environments. This other paper here is using similar technique, laser inscribed graphene for detection of pathogens, in this case, Salmonella. And again, very amenable for places that is low cost. It can be used multiple times in terms of, you can fabricate them so cheaply and scalably that you can measure them multiple times without the added cost. So very useful. The next examples that I have, it's about a work done at MIT by Professor Karnik. He developed very interesting, using nature to do that. He developed a filter that allows you to remove contaminants from water by using tree trunks. And again, it's a nano, if you look about the sizes of the tree trunk, this column here, it has is a nano size. And by doing the proper treatment of the tree trunk and using the proper tree trunk, he was able to make this last for a long time. So basically he dehydrated the tree trunk using alcohol and what it allows them for long time, last for a long time and be able to ship to regions of such as India. And by attaching them to a hose and allowing the water that people were going to consume to pass through that, it eliminates contaminants. And he is just showing before and after with a pigment. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but the water percolates through these small holes that you see on the tree trunks, in the xylem of the trunk of the tree. And he's showing an example of what it does in terms of microbial contamination. So he's able to filter out E. coli very effectively. And again, it doesn't need a lot of material. And it was very well accepted by the community because they saw that this is a natural material, something that they can find there. It's easy to adapt to their filter setup for the water, and then they feel comfortable using it. And so at this point, they are deploying that in media and collecting data to further distribute this around that area. And they are using a tree trunk in particular that is local to the area. So again, using nanotechnology to do that. And another example from Dr. Karnick's lab is about mercury contamination or heavy metal contaminations in areas in India. And what he's doing here is it's very difficult to test because, again, you have to collect the sample, ship to a lab, get it analyzed, and then get back. And it's costly, and people don't collect them enough to be able to pinpoint the contamination. So one way that he came about is repurposing cationic resins, ionic exchange resins. And what it does is he uses the community, he sends out them this kind of fan type of collector. And basically what it does is the people collect the water, 250 mils of water in that in a particular area that they believe is contaminated with heavy metals. And once it goes to a location there, they use this fan that has those little resins that are being repurposed, which has a very good binding affinity to heavy metals. They expose the water to this particular material. And then after that, they blot it dry, and they are able to put it in an envelope and ship to a lab that will do the analysis. So with that type of setup, what happened is people start doing more and getting information, getting involved, and they were able to pinpoint the areas where the water was contaminated and hopefully avoid consumption there. So again, these are a few of the examples that I wanted to point it out that it is possible for you if you understand the material that you are working with, and if you understand the context that you are working with, you can actually deploy this and be useful for the community that is in need. So success begins with the end in mind. And you're the scientist, you need to think about the end user, the implementers, the regulators, and the environmental aspects of things. And you can see here that we need this bridge. If we don't have that, then the connection is lost. And we need to come up with the right questions. So are we asking the good questions? Does this address the bottleneck? Is there a consumer benefit? What is the environment and safety impact? Is the approach efficient and scalable? If we don't ask those questions, unlikely the technology that we develop will be deployed or ever used. This become a very nice paper that nobody really puts to use. So those things are very important and to keep in mind. So opportunities and challenges are evolving. Recent advancements in nanotechnology are abound. So CRISPR, for example, is becoming commonplace. I didn't talk about that, but it is becoming commonplace. Material informatics making leaps and bounds. Sensors for water quality tracing, like I mentioned, also are becoming more and more available. We are now having funds, you can see on the news, IoT is becoming more penetrating more into ag and food systems, which it wasn't the case a couple of years ago. But we still have persistent challenges. So pre-pandemic inequity was there. Billions lack safely managed drinking water, sanitation services, and food to eat. And post-pandemic supply chains, so food, energy, water, sanitation, and health systems. So we still have those things that for some reason or another, many reasons to this complex system, they are still not completely tackled. And we need to keep in mind how they are interconnected. So one example was during the pandemic, right? Understanding the connections between the different aspects of things is crucial to emerge stronger from the COVID pandemic, for example. So again, there is not a silver bullet to a problem. There are all things that are interconnected, and system thinking can help. And concluding thoughts, I don't want to, again, delay too much, but trust the process. You may not need to understand all the connections amongst the puzzle pieces, but must allow ourselves to be temporarily out of focus and to see the problem anew. Avoid biasing research questions. So again, good questions always drive to the better ideation. So ask questions at the most granular level as possible. Utilize dynamic focusing in and out of focus. System thinking provides rich context. So loose connections amongst complex components reduces risks of catastrophic failure. Oh my gosh. Look for non-obvious relationships as well. So I have one more slide. It's a little bit long, but one thing that I would like to drive is different cultures have different values, and that needs to be respected and embraced. So if you're thinking about approaching a community to help them, you need to have that in mind. Working with nature instead of trying to outsmart it. Hopefully the example of the tree bench was a good one for you to think about. Food is more than fuel and indulgent to our bodies. Again, is one of the few things that we can choose that we have control of. So we need to be mindful of that. And nanotechnology portfolios are diverse. And time is one of the most important factors for technology adoption. Technology comes fast, but conversion takes time. And technology trade-offs, not trade-offs of stakeholders' needs. So again, ask the right questions and ask the good questions. Technology tools need to inform users about... So if you go about introducing a technology to a new community, you need to provide them opportunities of different technologies available so they can make a decision. And if a concerted and patient efforts is made to initiate technology appropriation and from one sets. And basically, you need to develop, after all, trust. So if you create trust in both sides, the scientific side and the community side or the society, things become deployable and usable. So with that, I finish. And I'm very open to questions. And I know I went fast in some of these slides, so feel free to ask me any questions and reach out to me if you
Thank agree. You very much again. Yeah, that was wonderful. We've got some questions in the Q&A session. Let me start with the quickest answer probably. Christine was asking if you could provide the journal papers that you mentioned here, if you could give us the links that we could easily also share that with the attendees. And there is a question coming from Leo that's saying, are there efforts in place that ensure that pest-resistant food is edible without health challenges?
Yeah, obviously, that's the question that people have, right? The trust that needs to be developed, that those things are not harmful to us. And those foods that are going to be consumed, they need to be proved to be safe. So there is a process every time you do some changes to food, that being surface treatments, that being applied genetically, they need to show that it's safe for consumption. So I would say that there is regulatory agencies that go through that before allowing foods that are being modified genetically to be consumed to be safe. So, right. Yes.
So derived from Leo's question, I would ask, like, are there like some filters, like you mentioned, that may be shown in the literature that are like still trying to filter out all the like other chemicals that might be staying on the top of the food? Is there anything like research going on in that field?
To remove, I guess the question that you have is, like before we eat, we will filter
out. Yeah. Something so, like that.
So I don't know if there is particularly one for removing pesticides, but what the research does is to show that the residence time of the pesticides in the food surface is not going to be harmful by the time we consume them. So they need to prove that. They cannot apply a particular pesticide and have residues to the levels that are not approved for consumption. That is regulated.
Mm-hmm. So we got a question from Deb. She's asking, you talk in depth about the waste that in the first part of the talk. Are there any impact of the waste in terms of percentage? There are like nano research going on to improve this waste. Can we link it to the first part of the talk?
Yes. So the examples I gave in terms of, maybe I can go back there, right? So the examples that I gave on how to tackle food waste, it's being done at, so for example here, when I give the examples of use more of the ugly, make them perfect, we are using, there is nanotechnology aspects of it going on. So let's see about, let me find one example in terms of using cellulosic conversion and making into food packaging. They are using nanomaterials to make food packaging more biodegradable or incorporating materials that are not initially used as packaging components, but they are at the nano level to be able to be incorporated into food packaging, for example. So all those layers that I'm showing here, there is some nanotechnology input happening. So let me see another example. Perfect shape, that wouldn't be ideal. But for example, here, there is a lot of work for delivery systems to be able to extract some nutraceuticals and be able to make them useful or better absorbable by our body. Or, for example, extracting pigments that not necessarily are used. So, for example, I can give you one grant that I'm being funded right now. Sorghum, not necessarily is a cereal that is consumed a lot by us here in the United States, but there are some sorghum varieties that are we call black sorghum. They are very rich in anthocyanins. That's what gives the pigment. However, those pigments, they tend to precipitate in regular beverages, in the pH that the beverages have. So one of the things that we are trying to do is use nanomaterials, such as nano-sized polymers, to make them be able to be in suspension for the beverage. So it's all food materials, it's all carbohydrates that we are allowed to consume, so pectins, and another one would be gamma arabic or alginate. That's another carbohydrate that we are working with to see if we can, by sandwiching the anthocyanin with this carbohydrate, we can make them in suspension for the whole shelf life of our beverage. And also to sustain thermal treatment, so pasteurization or high temperature, ultra-fast high temperature, UHT, so it's not refrigerated anymore, it's shelf life stable at room temperature. We are trying to develop things that make that feasible. So again, open up avenues for something that is underused and probably considered as feed for animals to become something that becomes available for humans to consume, and it actually promotes ideally health.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we just have one last question. We are almost time, but a very quick answer maybe. Anton is asking, how do you balance plant-based materials for nanotechnology and plant overuse?
Oh, that's a good question. And what would be the case of overuse? So I guess the idea here is, now, obviously, there is a balance and we need to keep things in perspective. So we don't want to all of a sudden one particular food product becomes the drive of that region, right? That disrupts the ecosystem. So can we balance it out, having a variety, a diversity of produce, and at the same time, reduce its waste without making that, like, let's say the case of the sorghum, right? All of a sudden it becomes so profitable that the whole fields of Iowa become sorghum-based. That wouldn't be ideal. So there is a balance, and we need to make sure that we don't turn the balance out of proportion. So just keeping, again, the more diverse, the better it will be. And I think that's when consumers can be, people, the community can be a voice to not allow the capitalist view of things overtake the drive. That would be my take.
Gotcha. Thank you very much. Yeah, this has been a great talk.
I want to thank you on behalf of the NAC Center and our audience here for a very, very inspiring talk for us. Thanks so much
again for giving me the opportunity to talk here. I know I went a little too fast sometimes, but I hope I give you guys some ideas of how we can tackle these big questions.
Thank you so much. All righty.
Thank you.